We're going to be looking at the book of Ruth today, and I hope that you get what I got from it this week. This was really transformational for me in just a variety of ways. I just felt like I changed by going through this, and I'll explain that as we go through it, but we're going to be talking about Ruth. Naomi has left her home, and tragedy has struck her and her family. And we left her last week in Moab without a husband and without her two sons and these two Moabite women that have married into the family. And we left her there. It's kind of like a cliffhanger. So now we're going to be talking about as her journey back home. A writer, David McCullough, tacked a plaque above his desk that reads, "Look at your fish." It's a story about the value of seeing. In an interview from the Paris Review, McCullough shared the story behind that short statement. He said, "It's the test that Louis Agassiz, the 19th century Harvard scientist, gave every new student. He would take a smelly old fish out of the jar, set it in a tin pan in front of the student, and he would say, 'Look at your fish. Look at your fish.' And then he would leave. And he would come back. And he'd ask the students what they had seen. And they would say, 'Not very much.' And then he would say again, 'Look at your fish.' This could go on for days. And the student was during this time to be encouraged to draw the fish and could use no tools for examination. Just sketch it out and touch it, and look with their eyes. One student who later became a famous scientist gave us the best account of what they called the ordeal of the fish. After several days, he could not see whatever it was that Agassiz wanted him to see, but he did say, 'I saw a little bit than I did before.' Agassiz walked in and he said, 'Paired organs, the same on both sides.' Agassiz said, 'Of course, of course.' Very pleased. The student asked, 'What do I do next?' 'What do you think?' he said. 'Look at your fish.' It shows us that often insight comes by studying and looking very closely as to what is before our eyes all along. That's what I did this week with this passage, and that's what I plan to do today. To look closely at the characters before us, to gather insight in the character of God, in the character of Naomi, and into the character of Ruth. And I hope what each one of us see that comes out of this story is a beautiful narrative of redemption and bringing someone back home to God. I put a picture up of Nemo, right? Because he's a fish, right? And look at that fish. He looks kind of sad right now. But don't we know there's a story behind Nemo? Nemo lost his mother, got into an argument with his father, got into some trouble, and then wandered far from home, and then had the help of a very unlikely friend to bring him back. Folks, everybody has a story. And we have to look closely at the stories of those lives that are in front of us and see what is going on in their lives and see what God is doing in their lives. Maybe today you're far from God. Maybe you're sitting here or you're watching, and even though you are physically present, your heart is in a distant land. Maybe you know someone that has traveled far from God. And maybe you're wondering, is there any hope for that person to return? I hope this story encourages you. And I hope that you can see that this is a story of the God who leads us back home to Him. I see four stages that we're going to be looking at today. The first stage in this story is the hearing, verses 6 through 7. Then she arose. So this is after the narrator says that both Mahlon and Chilion have died. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. For she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. In her book, Unbroken, author Laura Hillenbrand tells a story of Olympic runner and World War II POW survivor Louis Zamperini. As a young teenager living in Southern California, Louis was better known for causing trouble. As a matter of fact, thieving was a hobby of his, especially if the loot was food. He was constantly in trouble at school, constantly fighting with the other kids, and he cared absolutely nothing about getting good grades. His poor Italian immigrant parents worried so much about him, and they tried to do everything in their power to bring him back. As a matter of fact, his older brother, Pete, tried to help reform him by getting him involved in running track, but that seemed to fail as well. One day, Louis got angry about doing a chore, and he decided to run away. When he did, his parents pleaded with him to stay, but when he refused, they sent him off as lovingly as they knew how. Louis' mother made him a sandwich, and his father held out in his hand $2, a great deal of money for the family at the time. Louis took the gifts and left. He and a friend hitchhiked all the way to Los Angeles, and they jumped a train headed north. They found out that running away was not the adventure that they hoped it would be. They barely escaped an oven-like boxcar in which they had been locked into. They were caught and forced at gunpoint to leave the train while it was still moving. They had to walk for several days, and they wound up sitting on the ground in a rail yard. They were filthy, bruised, sunburned, wet, and sharing a can of stolen beans. As the train passed by, Louis could see the passengers as they sat comfortably inside. He said, "At that time, I saw beautiful white tablecloths, crystal on the tables, and food, lots of food. People laughing and enjoying themselves as they were eating. And there he was sitting, shivering, eating a miserable can of beans." He said, "At that time, I remembered the day that I left, and I remembered the compassion that I saw in my parents' face, and I remembered the sandwich that my mother made for me. I stood up," he said, "and I headed for home." I want us to see here in this section, as we begin this story, God uses a variety of ways to bring people back to him, or to him initially. Just like in our illustration, what does Louis remember? He remembers what? A sandwich. He remembers food. And here, God gets Naomi's attention with a sandwich. He gets her to turn around. She left Bethlehem. She left Judah because of a famine, and now it is food that is going to bring her back. How often is it that God uses a present physical need to get people's attention, to get them to turn to him? Notice what is happening here. She is remembering and she is seeing that God is providing for his people. There she is, and she's in this land. She's far away, and just like anyone, they could be like wondering, what on earth happened? What am I doing here? You know, maybe someone has tried to make their way in this world. They've tried to be successful, and then all of a sudden they find themselves in a place of utter desolation. And they notice God's community. They notice God's people. And something gets their attention. Hey, why do they have that peace about them? Even though they're suffering, God is providing for them. Hey, what is it about those Christians that they have that I don't have? that I've been seeking all along in this world and I haven't found it. But they're not seeking anything and they've got everything. God uses a variety of ways to get people's attention. And folks, nobody is ever too far away to hear God's call to him. I come from a family of loud talkers. I know you probably don't believe that, but that's a true statement. Matter of fact, we could be a foot away from each other and neighbors could hear us next door. Not just loud talkers, we're loud sneezers. I don't know if you've ever heard me sneeze, but you probably heard my dad sneeze all the way from Pennsylvania. My dad would sneeze so loud, my mom said he would wake the dead, which is probably true. I would say if my father sneezes that I can hear him all the way in Maine when he sneezes. As loud as that is, folks, we are never too far away to hear God's call back to him. Naomi is all the way in Moab, which is approximately 70 miles away from Bethlehem. But notice what the author says here. She just happens to what? Hear. She hears. She hears of God's grace and provision for his people. And there's no telling whether or not they repented in this town or not, or whether it doesn't say there was a national repentance at this time. So God had grace on his people. He gives them food in a time of need, and it gets Naomi's attention. And she's like, what on earth am I doing? It reminds us of the story of the prodigal son. There he was. He was away in a distant land. He spent all of his father's money, and he's eating with the pigs. And what happens? He's like, what am I doing? The slaves are living better than I am right now in my father's house. Maybe, and he's got low expectations, maybe he'll take me back. And so we have here God using a variety of ways to get people's attention, to bring them to him. And we don't know what it is. We don't know what it's going to be. And often is the case that we think sometimes, you know, we have to try to attract people. We have to try to draw them into Christianity. We got to make it fun. We got to make it exciting. God's doing that, folks. And he's doing that by providing for his people. And people on the outside see that. They hear about that and they go, I'm going to go check that out. I'm going to go see what's going on in that church right now. I'm going to go see what is so different about my neighbors. They hear, and they get up, and they begin a journey to him. Very important aspect of this is it says that she gets up from what? The place where she was. So the word for return here can be used for the word for repentance. It is a turning away from where we are. A turning away from that place, a turning away from that life, a turning away from the decisions that we are making, and a turning towards something else. That is exactly what Naomi is doing right now. She has traveled far from God, and now she is turning back to him. It begins by getting up from the place that we are at. And if you are in that place today, stand up and leave that place and begin that journey back to him. And it is a journey, folks. It doesn't happen overnight, and it's just begun for Naomi. And though she begins this physical walk back to Bethlehem, her heart is a lot further off, which leads us to our next stage, which is the herding. Verses 8 through 13. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, go, return, each of you, to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, no, but we will surely return with you to your people. But Naomi said, return, my daughters, why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? "Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you. For the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." I want us to notice that word return. We said when we're reading a narrative like that, like this, or reading a passage, we want to see for reoccurring words in that passage. And this is one that begins our passage and actually ends our passage as well. This is all about Naomi's return. She's gotten up now and she's turned to head back, and she wants to convince her daughters-in-law not to go with her. In the midst of her returning, Naomi is hurting. Naomi is in a ton of pain. You might do this, I'm not sure, but in the news it's become a very popular thing. You get into bed, you turn off the lights, and you look at your phone to check what news is happening, or Twitter one more time, or Facebook, or whatever it is, and all you see is doom and gloom. You see that coronavirus infections are going up. Maybe your kids can't go back to school. The economy is cratering. Still, you incessantly scroll through the bottomless doom and gloom news for an hour or so as you sink into a pool of utter despair. This habit has become known as doom scrolling. It's the act of consuming endless bad news, endless negative online news, as protest over racial injustice, police brutality join the COVID-19 crisis in the news cycle. It's only become worse. The constant stream of news and social media never ends. According to a recent survey from the Pew Research Center, 66% of Americans feel worn out by the amount of news that they have been viewing. Recently, Dictionary.com named doom scrolling one of its new words we created because of the coronavirus. It said there's something in that word, the etymology, particularly in the word doom. The act of doom scrolling is a roll towards annihilation. It reminds us of the book of Revelation. Simultaneously, each person watches the demise of so much while they are slowly destroying themselves. Naomi, I think, has been doom scrolling over her life, not over the news, but over all the events that have taken place in her life. And by going over these events over and over and over again, she is destroying herself. Naomi is in a ton of pain. With the help of a good friend this week, my eyes were opened to this woman. I'm extremely grateful for what my friend told me. My friend told me to read Ruth through the eyes of a woman. So I tried to channel my inner Hallmark character. That is this guy, Dale Midkiff, right here. Actually, he's like the worst Hallmark character, and we always make fun of him because he is just so emotional, and I think he's an overactor. But all joking aside, my friend was absolutely correct. Everybody has a story. The question is, do we hear it? When we read a passage like this, so my position on Naomi was bad, Naomi. You have no faith, Naomi. You're angry at God, Naomi. I'm never going to be like Naomi. You see some women shaking their heads here? Rightfully so. Many commentators rake Naomi across the coals, I was planning to do that. I was going to be like, don't be a Naomi. You know, don't blame God. Don't be angry. But then as I tried to look at her humanly and with compassion, and as I believe God views us, in the midst of our pain, in the midst of our anger, in the midst of our hurting, instead of condemnation, I had compassion on her. Whether right or wrong, and her response to God, her view of God in her circumstances is incorrect, but that those circumstances, that view of God has been brought upon because of all the pain that she has suffered in her life. This woman lost her husband as soon as she enters into the land of Moab. And then she's like, well, there's still hope. I still got my boys. They produce no offspring. And then they die. And during this time, to be a woman in a situation like that was hopeless. Naomi doesn't have a retirement package. Matter of fact, she probably can't even go home to a family that's going to care for her needs. This is an older, elderly woman in a time where the husbands and the men were the sole providers of that house. She is utterly hopeless, and she says that. And she's in pain. And her pain has caused her to view God in an incorrect way. But whether right or wrong, the pain is real. It's there. And we have to hear that. For the hand of the Lord is against me. And when we're in pain, when we view that God's hand is against us, we give bad advice to other people. And that's basically what she is telling these girls. Look, don't cast your lot with me. Look at what happened in my life. And I can almost think that she probably doesn't even think she's going to make it back home. The journey is 70 miles, and it is through treacherous terrain in a time where men weren't so respectful. She's like, look, this is what God has done in my life. If you come with me, you have no hope whatsoever. You might not even make it back alive. And she tells him that because her view of God is not a view of loving kindness, but a view of affliction. But we don't have to stay there because none of us have ever felt that way, have we? I thought about this week, and I've had a back pain for many years now. And it's something as small as a back pain, when I was suffering with it into a higher degree, made me get angry at God. I blamed him. Hey, you created me. You made my back. You can heal me. Why are you letting me go through this, Lord? Don't you know, Lord, I'm trying to serve you? My back goes out. I can't do my job, Lord. Why are you doing this? Blame, anger, and I lost hope. I'm like, I'm never going to be the same again. I used to be young and fit and doing all these things. I'm never going to, and trust me, ask my family. They know about it. They deal with that complaining. That's back pain. Naomi lost her entire family. She lost her entire family, and she has no hope for a future. What is interesting here is in this context, the author brings out a characteristic of God that takes central theme in this book, his loving kindness. Notice what she says, and I'm wondering here, is there a little smidgen of faith in what Naomi is saying to her daughters? And casting off her daughters like this really is, I believe, a selfless act, because she needed all the help she could get. But because she perceived God as against her in this way, she's like, don't come near me. Don't, you guys have hope. I got nothing. You come with me, you're going to be in the same lot. But notice she invokes God's loving kindness in their lives, the same loving kindness. She basically challenges God to show them the same loving kindness that they have shown her in her life. And I want us also to see here that by her recognizing that loving kindness, isn't that God still caring for Naomi through these girls? Absolutely. And it shows us that even when we are at the lowest point in our lives, when we look up and we're like, I got nothing, I got no hope whatsoever, what is God doing? He's caring for her. And it's on her lips, but it's so far from her heart. The loving kindness, because she blesses them and she wants God's loving kindness in her life, peace and rest. And she recognizes that God cares about those things in people's lives, right? That he is intimately acquainted with people, that he can help people in their situation because they have suffered too. And she invokes it for them, but she doesn't believe it for herself. Pain does that. Pain hardens us, and that's what Naomi's experiencing right now. The word for loving kindness, it says, it's a significant theological term in this book. As one commentator states, that it's the depth of the meaning of this word cannot be captured with one single English word. It is a term of endearment and commitment, while incorporating all of the positive attributes of God, his love, his covenant faithfulness, his mercy, his grace, his kindness, his loyalty, all demonstrated in acts of devotion. These actions go beyond duty. This hesed love would bring the opposite of pain and grief that these women have been experiencing. Isn't that interesting? In the midst of her pain and grief, she asks for this loving kindness for these two girls, but does not believe it can happen in her own life. Folks, that is a woman in pain. Blaming, yes. Angry, yes. Hurting, absolutely. I love this definition of hesed love. The love that will not let you go. That's the loving kindness that God has for us. Loving kindness that he has for Naomi. And we're going to see it's a love that won't let her go. The third stage here is the help, verses 14 through 18. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. I guess Naomi gets the hint. It was one of the worst days of 23-year-old Bretton Wynn's life, but it also paved the way for one of his best. Bretton was extremely angry at God. He had relapsed from an addiction to methamphetamines. He knew absolutely nothing about Central Baptist Church of Conway, Arkansas, when he broke into it one evening. He was high on drugs, and he went on a rampage and destroyed $100,000 of church property. 6 months later, he was baptized there. He said this, I'm starting to understand how God works. I realize now I didn't pick that church that night. God picked me. If it had been any other church, I think I'd be sitting in prison right now. Wynn's journey from a jail cell in February to a baptismal pool in September began when Central Baptist senior pastor Don Chandler talked with the prosecutor. Chandler knew that the godly response to Wynn would be to offer forgiveness rather than judgment. Chandler said, "You can't preach grace for 50 years without practicing it, especially in front of your entire church." This was a young man who had made some serious mistakes. Yes, he was an addict. Yes, he was doing drugs and alcohol, but that doesn't make him unredeemable. Chandler told the prosecutor that the church would like to see Wynn get some help at Renewal Ranch. It's a faith-based residential recovery ministry. The judge, who at one time had been a board member of the ranch, gave Wynn the option, 20 years in prison or go to the ranch. Wynn chose the ranch. Later on, he accepted Christ as his Savior at one of the Bible studies there. They attend the church on Wednesday evenings, Wynn and the other residents. Wynn said, "I gave my heart to Christ that night." He said, "I used to think that it was a coincidence that I chose to break into that church, but now I call it a confirmation that God is real, working in our lives. I needed that relationship with Jesus Christ." I left off the ing here because this is really the climax of this section and one of the big climax of our entire story. God sends help to the helpless. This is God's grace in the life of Ruth, and this is God's grace in the life of Naomi. And that grace often comes in extremely unexpected ways. Just like our illustration, forgiveness rather than judgment. So Naomi is mad at God, right? So God takes her in a corner, right? And he says, "Hey, don't you know how much I've given you? Don't you see how I have worked in your life? You know, I could have taken you out the moment you guys left Bethlehem." Is that what God does? No. What does he do? He's going to work in the life of Naomi through the life of Ruth. And Ruth is going to be one of the major factors that brings Naomi all the way back home to his heart. God uses ordinary people of extraordinary faith to work in the lives of others, and that is what he is doing in the life of Naomi right now. The help that Naomi receives is on her way back home, and it is this help that will eventually lead her all the way. Ruth's conversion here is rightfully called legendary. She converts, and the book is named after her, I believe, because she is such a contrast to the faith of Naomi. And we have to remember, throughout this story, the author is setting up these contrasts for us to see. Naomi, right, she doesn't have a lot of faith right now. Yes, because of all the pain. Yes, because of all the hurting. But she's looking at things from a physical perspective. She's got no hope physically. And here, Ruth, this pagan, has no hope whatsoever. Naomi has just tried to convince her, "Hey, look, there is absolutely nothing for you, right? You got nothing. You got nothing, 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 nothing." Ruth puts aside every single base of security behind her and says, "I don't care." Folks, that's faith. That is commitment. And Ruth is this bright light, not only in the life of Naomi, but in all of Israel right now. And what does that show us? Even in the darkest, the most spiritually dark times of our lives, of our nation, of our land, God is still working. God is bringing people to Him. It doesn't stop. God's own people were faithless during this time. It doesn't stop God's plan. And this conversion becomes part of that line to bring in the individual who is going to change this world. Ruth. Grace in unexpected places. Unexpected in the life of Ruth and unexpected in the life of Naomi. We'll listen to what she says here. Listen what a conversion and what a commitment looks like. After some attempts to get her not to go. So remember, she's actually being dissuaded. It's like a Christian telling an unbeliever, dude, you don't want any mess of this stuff. It's so bad. Just forget it. Go back to your gods. Do what you've been doing. That life is fun, right? You know, that you got some chance there. And then God's still drawing that person through His grace, and they're like, no, you know what? I want this. And I'm going to tell you how much I want this. She says, your land is my land. Remember, she's a foreigner. And she was a foreigner that was despised by the people to where she was going. And then she doesn't turn around to Naomi and be like, hey, you know what? Before I continue, how many levels you got? You got a washer and dryer? You got some running water? Because all those, I mean, the bed is really important. Where I lay my head at night, if it's not comfortable, do you got a MyPillow? Because that's what I want. And if you got that stuff, guess, hey, MyPillow, yep, thinking of you. If you got that stuff, I'm coming with you, right? You got running water, you got a bathroom. No, she says, where you lodge, I'm going to lodge. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if her house looks like Eeyore's home, right? Those sticks. I'm in it. Committed to the land, committed to the place, committed to the people. You think there's some crazies in that lot in Bethlehem? Absolutely, folks. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You think there's some people that are going to get on Ruth's nerves? Going to bother Ruth? That's commitment. She doesn't know a lick of, she doesn't know one of them. And she says, I'm committed, and ultimately she is committed to God, and she's not committed to God for His benefit package only. She is committed to Him wholeheartedly. And she's in it for the long haul. She pronounces a curse upon herself, basically. She enters into a covenant. And she says, may God do to me if anything but death separates us. Folks, that is commitment. Commitment to the Lord, commitment to His people, commitment to where He puts us, and commitment until we die. How many people would like a friend like Ruth? Yeah? Can you imagine? Do you think that's a person that can pull us out of our despair? Absolutely. Think that's a person that we can look at them, and even now as I look at that legendary faith that she has, I'm like, holy cow, she puts me to shame. And God is going to use her to bring Naomi back to Him. Let me ask you another question. How many of us are a friend like Ruth? It's kind of hard, isn't it? To commit ourselves like that, commit ourselves to a church family, commit ourselves to the individuals in the church, commit ourselves to where God has us. I always say that that which we want in our lives is that which we should be to others. And here, eventually, she gives in. Naomi says, okay, You got it. Ruth clings to her. Never, ever gonna let her go. And though they have now, in this next section, returned back home physically, Naomi still remains, her heart, far off from God. The fourth and final stage that we see here is the healing, verses 19 through 22. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Again, we have the word return. So they've made it all the way back. And though Naomi has returned physically, she has not returned spiritually. She has not, because she believes that God has dealt very bitterly with her, and she is bitter towards God, and she wants everybody to know about it. When former Pittsburgh Steeler Lynn Swan achieved the pinnacle of individual success for every NFL player, which is the entrance into the Hall of Fame, he expressed some bitter feelings that he had on his mind for quite some time. In his book, Keep It Simple, Swan's quarterback, football great Terry Bradshaw, said at that time, Swan blamed him for not being voted into the Hall of Fame sooner. According to Bradshaw, Swan's words on that day of celebration were this: Bradshaw did not seem like he wanted to throw the ball in my direction at all. The guy has 4 Super Bowl rings, but could he read secondaries, which was his position? He goes, "I doubt it." What made Bradshaw decide not to throw more passes to me at the end of my career? I have no idea. I have no idea. Bradshaw commented on this. He said, "I kept thinking how sad it was that on that day, which should have been one of the greatest days of his life, he chose to create such a controversy. Why let that past experience spoil such a wonderful day? Instead of using that opportunity to release some anger, he could have enjoyed all the honors due to him. He should have been thrilled." Like here in our illustration, this coming home for Naomi could have been a time of celebration of God's blessings in her life. Not only did God preserve her through the treacherous journey 70 miles home, but he provided a companion for her along the way, and one who is going to remain faithful to her and help her out in her older age, and eventually is going to be a blessing beyond belief to not only Naomi, but to all of Israel. What is interesting about this is she says, "I have returned empty," but is really missing what God is filling her with. And it is literally right before her eyes. You ever been around a person like that? Where they've experienced all that negative, and it's real pain, it's real hurt, but what Naomi has done is she has nurtured that all these years, and it has produced a root of bitterness in her life. You know, people where everything's negative and you're just hanging out with them and they're like, this is so bad, my life. And I want you to know about it too. I'm going to tell you how bad my life is. And that's it. They're all celebrating. Naomi's back. She's like, "Don't call me Naomi. uh-uh, which means pleasant. The shortened form before is the longer form is kindness of Yahweh. She's like, I'm not pleasant at all. Oh no, I'm bitter because God's been bitter towards me. And I want you all to know about it. She's angry at God because what she had perceived, what happened to her incorrectly. And now that anger over all of these years, nurtured over and over again, gave root to such a bitterness. That's what happens in our lives. When we allow all of that hurt and all of that pain and we develop that into anger and we allow that anger to build up in us, it overwhelms us. And we want everyone else to know how hard it's been in our lives. I can imagine Ruth standing there and be like, what am I, chopped liver? Did you forget about me? She just committed her life to her. She's like, I'm going to be with you. And she's like, yeah, this is my friend Ruth. She's really nice. She just committed herself to God and everything else and left behind her. She doesn't say any of that. Blinded by bitterness. I love this quote. Bitterness does more harm to the vessel in which it is stored than the vessel on which it is poured. Isn't that the truth? You're around a bitter person, right? And thankfully, Ruth is still hanging out with Naomi, even though she's this bitter, cranky old woman, right? But you hang out with people like that, and you don't want to stay there too long, do you? Because you start getting bitter. And you can leave those people, but those people can't leave themselves. And that bitterness is a toxin. And all it's going to do is going to eat away at our hearts, and it's going to blind our eyes to what God is doing before us. Starts sounding like a sad country song. Dog's dead, girl's gone, truck ain't working. Everything is bad. That's what happens in our pain. When we're hurting, we tend to turn inwards and look at everything through that pain and suffering and miss what God is doing right before our eyes. I wanted to end not on a bitter note. I wanted to end with the healing, because the healing in Naomi's life takes time. But notice, the author doesn't end on the bitter note. He ends with, so Naomi returned with someone, with Ruth. She's been wounded. She's in pain. God has applied the ointment that is going to heal this woman's heart. And that healing, for some folks, takes longer than others. And it just so happens that they return at the beginning of the harvest. Coincidence? I think not. In the movie The Horse Whisperer, Tom Booker, played by actor Robert Redford, employs his special gift of gentling horses. A tense New York Magazine editor can't believe her eyes as she witnesses this gentling and the gradual transformation of her daughter's horse from traumatized to tamed. In one telling scene, the horse that was frightened by the editor's ringing cell phone runs off to the far edge of a large pasture. Booker walks into the pasture and sits down, and he waits for what appears to be hours. The horse is eventually drawn to him by its curiosity, begins to inch closer and closer and closer. So eventually, Booker can place his hand on the horse, calm it down, and gently lead it back to the safety of its stall. God's hand of loving kindness guides our hearts back home to Him. I found myself like that editor as I watched God's loving hand guide Naomi, or begin to guide Naomi, back to his home. God gentles us back to him. The loving kindness of the Lord leads to repentance. How he piqued her curiosity with food. How he was showing his loving kindness through those two girls. How he changed the life of a Moabite woman who will change the life of this woman and the entire world. I hope that this passage has given you hope today. Hope for those who you think are too far from him ever to come back, and hope for yourself if your heart has drifted away from him. I hope that you can see it's never too late to return home. Father, thank you for the way that you gentle us to you. You're not harsh, not judgmental. You're kind and loving. Lord, I pray for all of those who may be far off from you today. Help them to see how much you love them and how much you want to bring them back to the safety of your heart, Lord. We ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.